From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America presents Issues in the News. The nation's top Washington correspondents offer their perspectives on the week's major stories. Your moderator is Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Issues in the News begins now.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me on the show this week are David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist, and for the first time on our program, Gopal Ratnam, Senior Staff Writer at Foreign Policy Magazine, covering the White House, the Pentagon, and broader national security issues. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And here are the issues. A new diplomatic mission to Moscow was launched by the leaders of France and Germany aimed at ending the increasingly violent conflict in eastern Ukraine. In Washington, the Obama administration said it may send military weapons to Ukraine, a change in policy favored by President Obama's choice as the new defense secretary. Meanwhile, a Jordanian pilot was burned to death by Islamic State, the terrorist group in Syria and Iraq. In response, Jordan stepped up air attacks on Islamic State, the terrorist group. And new questions were raised about whether the military response to Islamic State is sufficient. Well, David, let me ask you first. When I read about and hear about another diplomatic mission that wants to get Vladimir Putin, the Russian president, to stop doing what he's doing, I kind of roll my eyes.
I think the problem is, fundamentally, we're not about to have a war with Russia to throw them out of Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
The second fact on the ground is that Ukraine's army will never defeat the Russian army.
Mm-hmm.
The final fact on the ground is that what happens in Ukraine matters a great deal more to Vladimir Putin than it does to us in the West
mm-hmm.
and to President Obama. So those are the sort of the three kind of cruel planks of reality that we're dealing with. So I think that when people hear discussions about sending more American weaponry or sending, you know, lethal weaponry, the word of the week in here in Washington, they need to understand there isn't going to be a war led by the West to throw Vladimir Putin out of Ukraine. This White House, this administration, has a kind of theory of the case when it comes to bad actors in the world, which is kind of an appeal to their rationality, that there's a kind of disappointment as they look at these bad people like Vladimir Putin and think, why doesn't he see that what he is doing is irrational and not in the best long-term interests of his own country? And so there's a desire always to kind of make people see, to change the political calculation, to make people see that they're pursuing a futile course. They will need to negotiate the end of this because it can't carry on like this. So I think what we're seeing is not anything that's going to make the sort of the balance of the military conflict decisively different. What you're seeing is America ratcheting up the pressure in the hope that this will in some way make Vladimir Putin come to the table and do a deal. And the reason we're seeing this fresh diplomatic initiative, of course, is because essentially Vladimir Putin didn't like the last deal he did.
He's decided to
tear up his contract and see if he can get a better deal.
Well, that doesn't sound to me like the West is dealing from strength. But what's your take on this, Gopal?
Well, I think on the point that David was making, which is ratcheting up pressure, my sense is that the White House really is not very keen or particular to actually send even these defensive arms and so-called lethal aid to Ukraine. And I think they are hoping that by sort of signaling very publicly that they would indeed consider this, they might be able to change Putin's calculus. And I think they've already changed some amount of calculus on the part of Germany, where I think the Chancellor Merkel is said to be opposed to the idea of the Americans sending any more, you know, military assistance and aid to Ukraine. And so she is now attempting to put more pressure on Putin to back away from this venture in Ukraine. So I think that seems to be the calculation. And people, again, I've talked to are saying it's not clear, even if the White House actually agrees to send, you know, weapons and the anti-tank missiles and so on, what is the next step? What comes after that? I think they're still asking those questions.
Well, those are good questions. I think Moscow, and you hear it here in the United States, the response that if military weapons are sent, even defensive weapons, are sent to Ukraine, it will only widen the war and make things worse.
It's true. I think there's one of the calculations I heard. There was a background briefing, and I talked to a few people who did the report last week, the 8-member panel that actually recommended sending more military aid to Ukraine. I think there's some thinking that by sending these additional weapons to Ukraine, if the conflict were to widen, and if there are more deaths on the rebel side, and that might somehow change the calculus for Putin and the Russian public opinion might change, seeing that Russia needs to now step in, send more of its people, and maybe there are a few more deaths. So that seems to be the calculation, but it's not clear if indeed, you know, like somebody was saying the other day, if somehow the Russian mothers being afraid of their sons dying will change Putin's calculus. Mm-hmm. I mean, that seems to be the trajectory mm-hmm. that people are thinking about.
Joe Paul makes a very good point. That seems to be one of the points of leverage. If you talk in private to American officials, you know, there have been previous Russian offensives which halted suddenly. And mm-hmm. if you talk to American officials in private, they will say that one of the things that happened was one assault was halted because the Ukrainians had a bunch of Russian military identity cards proving that there were Russian military mm-hmm. personnel there and threatened to make them public. And that was sufficiently painful for Vladimir Putin domestically that he didn't want to admit that they had lost this many Russian kids in Ukraine, that he backed off. And so there is a sense that although Putin wants this more than we do and is willing to take more pain mm-hmm. than we are, and so, as you're right, that means we're dealing from a position of, you know, not strength, but he has his vulnerabilities too.
What would work with him? I can't imagine what it is. And along with that, is there any legitimacy to his position? And I mean, to what he's doing, what we know he's doing, not what he says he's doing, but what he's doing.
There's absolutely no legitimacy to what he's doing in terms of, you know, the sovereign entirety. He dislikes the historical fact that Ukraine became a separate country. He doesn't regard it as a proper separate country. He dislikes the fact that the former Soviet Union leader, Nikita Khrushchev, mm-hmm. gave the Crimea to Ukraine as a kind of mm-hmm. you know, dowry when it became a country within the Soviet system. But he just redrew those lines on the map by force, and that's mm-hmm. not how international order works. I think the tragedy here for Russia is that although in the short term Vladimir Putin is achieving a lot of his goals in terms of destabilizing Ukraine, keeping Ukraine, you know, so messy and so sort of fragile that it's not about to join NATO and join the West, and, you know, a frozen conflict often suits Russia in sort of horrible and cynical ways. But the long-term pain that's being inflicted on Russia, these sanctions that the West has put on Russia, and the fact that because the Russians have shown themselves to be such unreliable partners, you know, Europe really is diversifying some of its economic interests away from Russia. I mean, this is going to have very, very grave long-term consequences for Russian interests. The Russian economy is tanking right now, mm-hmm. and Europe is, you know, maneuvering away from dealing with Russia as a legitimate trading partner.
Well, I certainly agree with that, but what about the short-term consequences? I mean, there was speculation and even expectation that the drop in oil prices would have an effect on Putin. Doesn't seem to have yet. And then the sanctions as well. Why haven't they?
Well, I think now there's even more talk if, in fact, the meeting between Merkel and Putin mm-hmm. Doesn't yield or doesn't produce any change, that there might be a further round of sanctions, more tightening. Hmm. And I think there's already been a little bit of an uptick in the oil prices in the last few days.
Yes.
And so that probably speaks to the reason why the pain hasn't been felt as much as the West had hoped in the case of Russia. And also to another point, I think I'm beginning to get the sense that Russia's role in you know, the Iranian nuclear talks and their support that is needed for that is probably going to change after the March deadline. And we might see, you know, maybe more options being available both to the West and to the United States.
You mean in Ukraine?
In the case of Ukraine, yeah. to inflict further mm-hmm. additional pain on Russia.
Mm-hmm. David, what should we make of Ashton Carter, who President Obama has nominated to be defense secretary, who, quite frankly, talked about the areas in which he disagrees with the Obama administration, and one of them, he disagrees with the current policy of not sending military arms to Ukraine, also disagrees on or is leery of releasing prisoners from Guantanamo prison and so on. I just wonder whether that will have any effect. Is this representing, you know, sort of a trial balloon in his case of what the Obama administration might do?
You know, Ashton Carter is representing, I think, the authentic voice of very powerful people at the top of the Pentagon. You know, he's mm-hmm. a Pentagon guy.
Yep.
He comes from, you know, many years in very senior positions at the Pentagon. He's your classic kind of last defense secretary of a president's second term. He is a technocrat. He's yeah. he's an official. He's not an outsider being brought in to be a kind of big political mm-hmm. figure. He represents the machine, a certain part of the machine. And, you know, it's been clear, because the Pentagon is a leaky place, that some of the big generals, some of the big commanders have been chafing at the restraints They've been chafing at the incoherence of a lot of administration policy, that one of the oddities of this administration is you can't say 100% that the White House has a pacifist view and doesn't believe that weapons might help under any circumstances in Ukraine or in, you know, any other crisis like, you know, Syria or whatever. The oddity of this administration is that they quite often say, we think that weapons might help, we're worried they might do some damage, and then the policy kind of freezes and weapons are not delivered. And so I think when Ashton Carter, in his confirmation hearing in the Senate this week, said that he was keen to, that his personal view was that there was a role for more lethal weaponry, he wasn't just expressing a kind of policy position. I think he was also conveying a sense of deep frustration from the top of the machine, that America has already committed itself to all kinds of things. You know, American policy is to topple President Assad, or at least to see him gone. American policy is to vehemently oppose what President Putin is doing in Ukraine and to raise the costs to the point that he renegotiates. That's already American policy. So the kind of political risk has been taken, but there's never follow-up in terms of delivering those weapons or delivering even, you know, some of the non-lethal stuff. So I think it was not just an expression of a policy preference or, you know, as you say, flying a trial balloon or, you know, flying a kite to see if a different policy might work. It's not even a change of policy. I think it's an expression of frustration that the existing policy doesn't then get any follow-up from this administration.
Well, Ashton Carter is certainly a, as David said, a reliable Washington figure. I mean, I've been in Washington my entire life, actually. I grew up here. And, of course, I've been hearing his name for, you know, decades. And I think David's right. He is the sort of guy, reliable guy you bring in toward the end of your administration.
It's true. I mean, to the point of, do Carter's remarks during his confirmation hearing, do they suggest change in policy? The question is, I think, probably not, because just today there is a new national security strategy that's being announced by the White House. And one of the key elements of that, the president argues in a sort of a cover introduction letter to the strategy, is this idea of strategic patience, that the United States ought to have strategic patience as it confronts the world's problems. And I think there is some language in there that says the United States cannot get involved in every conflict and hope to change the trajectory of the conflict. It's almost as if it's justifying its sort of the policy that this administration has followed for the last 4 years. And so if you put that in the context of what Carter is saying, Carter may be, like David is saying, is just echoing the frustrations of the Pentagon. But in terms of his ability to actually change the policy when it comes to dealing with the White House, the president, and his closest advisors, I'm not seeing a lot of running room there. But I think on the one issue there where we might actually see some sort of a break from what the administration has said so far is probably Afghanistan, where things are really going bad and people are so focused on Islamic State, on Iraq and Syria and Ukraine, that the spotlight on Afghanistan is probably a little less now. But I think that's where we're likely to actually see, and that's something Carter again said during his confirmation hearing, that he's willing to relook at the timeline for withdrawal. So that might suggest actually a slight change in policy.
In other words, to leave American troops there longer than is now scheduled. I think
that's
they're
right.
all supposed to be gone
Come
by the end
of 2016.
Yeah.
Right.
David, what about that? Afghanistan.
Gopal makes a very good point. That was a striking moment in his testimony. The problem is, let's not forget why we have a new defense secretary in front of the Senate being confirmed. It's because the current defense secretary, the outgoing defense secretary, Chuck Hagel, was effectively sacked. And he was effectively sacked because, although, frankly, he has not been a very aggressive or robust defense secretary, when he did finally push back on some policy issues and finally was mildly rebellious and chafed against the hyper-politicized national security policy run by the White House and the machine, they couldn't tolerate it. And so he was sacked. And his sacking told whoever was the next defense secretary that they were not going to be there to make policy.
Do you think Ashton Carter knows that?
I'm sure he does, and that's why someone like Ash Carter has taken that job.
All right. Well, we'll have more in just a minute. First, a reminder, you're listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard, and joining me today are Gopal Rotman of Foreign Policy Magazine, and which comes out six times a year, so it's not a quarterly, and David Rennie of The Economist. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. The program is also available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com, Issues in the News. Well, here's my final question about this mission to Moscow. Might we get some new agreement? We know these don't last very long, but might there be a new one?
I mean, doing agreements with Russia is always a sort of an interesting game, because Russia's game is legalism.
Well, it's probably better to do them than not, though, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, there will be another deal. It will not hold, because Russia's interest is not ending this. Unfortunately, the real tragedy is Russia's interest is quite possibly in having another frozen conflict, a zone of unclear sovereignty, which they can take advantage of indefinitely.
One quick point on that. I mean, I think for the Obama administration, too, I think they would want to show that they did everything diplomatically possible. And so having one more agreement, even if, like David says, it's going to fail, would allow them to at least sort of justify the change in policy and start arming Ukrainians down the road.
Well, let's turn to the Jordanian pilot who, at least we believe from the video that was shown, that he was burned to death by Islamic State. Pretty gruesome. And the leader of Jordan was in the United States, and I've talked to members of Congress. I heard from him, and he was furious and talking about revenge and so on. Very, very strong language. The jet fighter attacks on Islamic State in Syria, anyway, were increased dramatically. Where does this lead, David?
It's easier to take revenge on Islamic State than it is to defeat Islamic State. I think that's, you know, one obvious problem that we face. I mean, if you look at what the strategy is, if you try and sort of analyze what is the strategy to initially contain and then degrade and destroy, dismantle Islamic State, there's a lot of stuff going on now. There's more airstrikes than ever before. There's more training of potential kind of moderate allies who might fight them in Syria than before. It doesn't add up to something that seems likely to work. There's so many sort of moving parts to this that you get a real sense of frustration again. I mean, Gopal talks to these people more often than I do, but my impression is that people inside the machine are in something sort of close to despair, because they can tell you the individual sort of parts of things that are being done, but no one I've spoken to has a kind of coherent sense of what America's overall plan for, you know, even containing ISIS effectively is.
Well, there's a debate in the United States, at least among conservatives anyway, about whether the U.S. needs to do more. And Max Boot, who some of you all may know, who writes on these foreign policy subjects, says this. Here's what he thinks needs to be done. We need to boost the U.S. military presence, loosen restrictions on bombing, end the prohibition on U.S. boots on the ground, let U.S. special forces accompany Iraqi and Syrian forces into battle, and call in airstrikes directly on ISIS positions, send in the U.S. Joint Special Operations Command to take down ISIS commanders, and he goes on and on and on. That doesn't sound, Gopal, as something that the Obama administration's about to do.
That's true. I don't think the Obama administration wants to do that. I think they've been extremely clear that this is a fight that the countries in the region have to step up. And
They have.
But I think the key part of the struggle against the Islamic State is really focused on Iraq. And there, I think the ability of the Iraqi government to really come around and create a force that can push back on Islamic State is yet to be seen. And one of the key elements of this strategy was to get the Sunni tribes in Iraq to be armed and equipped by the Iraqi government and have them be the sort of the leading force to push back on Islamic State. Mm-hmm. That hasn't happened yet.
Well, it's a Shiite government that may not want to arm Sunnis.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And so I think it still is a work in progress in terms of the administration trying to convince Abadi, the Iraqi prime minister, to do that is still ongoing. Mm-hmm. But I think to Max Boot's point, I think the counter-argument to that is, well, we had 100,000-plus troops in Iraq not too long ago. Mm-hmm. And we did actually manage to push back a lot of these, the groups that went by a different name before they became Islamic State. And then the moment we left, they're back again. And so what's the guarantee now that if you put maybe 15, 20,000 call-in strikes and, you know, do the damage, then what? What happens after that? I think that's the question that the administration is asking. And I think, to be fair to them, I think what they're looking for is to have the Iraqi government be the one that, you know, make sure that these guys don't rise up again. Mm-hmm. And I think it's still, that's not in place.
One of the differences in about this effort in against ISIS is that it does have the backing at the moment of the American public. And we know the war in Iraq certainly lost American support. Americans really don't want to have another war. But in this case, David, all the polls show a strong support for the effort against ISIS.
Well, I think what they show is a very strong desire to feel safe.
Well,
a very
that
strong
too.
Desire to protect America, and, you know, public opinion was very shaken by, you know, the beheading of American journalists last year. There's a kind of Jacksonian side to America. If you prod the American lion, you know, it will lash out. I think Gopal is absolutely right that if you speak to people in the White House, they say, look, we had more than 100,000 troops there, and that, you know, ultimately did not prove to be a long-term solution. I think if you were a politician...
Yeah, but how about a short-term solution?
Well, no, but here's the thing, Fred, is I think that if you're talking about American public opinion, which is very important, the real thing that could destroy this government is a terrorist attack here. I think that if you were an American politician or even a British politician or a French politician, yes, you worry greatly about what's happening in Jordan and Syria and Iraq. But what really terrifies you is the way that this conflict is also drawing in volunteers from your own countries, sending them back with British, French, American passports to commit terror attacks, at the moment mostly in Europe. It's that kind of metastasizing of the global jihad that really keeps America and other Western governments awake. So I think although they clearly would like to find a strategy in the region, and Gopal is absolutely right, it's kind of an Iraq-first strategy at the moment, I think if you were to look at what really, really worries President Obama and his advisors in terms of American public opinion, it's that intelligence effort, it's that counter-terrorism effort, it's about stopping this from producing atrocities on Western streets.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem to me, Gopal, that this is a fight where strategic patience will work. In other words, they need to do something in the short run here, don't you think, that's stronger than what they're doing? It may not be Max Boot's strategy, which is pretty elaborate, but don't they need American policy? Doesn't it need to be more vigorous?
Well, I think if you ask the White House, they would tell you that having now agreed to send as many as 4,000 American troops mm-hmm. into Iraq to sort of back up the Iraqi military and provide them with some more additional training and help them sort of plan this big battle that's coming to retake the city of Mosul in Iraq is a significant commitment.
Mm-hmm.
But to the point whether the American troops themselves should be fighting this battle,
mm-hmm.
I think I've heard people say, should another American soldier be dying to retake the city of Mosul? I mean, to your question about strategic patience, I mean, I think the way Obama characterized this in that interview he did with CNN
mm-hmm.
A couple of weeks ago, you know, he talks about putting the threat from Islamic State in perspective. And I think for him and his advisors, they seem convinced that the retaking of territory in Iraq and in Syria is not a very high priority American concern. This should be a concern for the countries in the region. And to David's point, the administration would rather focus more on preventing any of these guys from coming and staging attacks here. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's the way they see it. Mm-hmm. And so for them, I think short-term tactical loss, loss mm-hmm. of a city, loss of town, and being unable to dislodge Islamic State from a few towns in Iraq and Syria is not such a big deal if they can still hold together all this coalition and get them to push back in a more effective fashion.
Yeah, my impression, correct me if I'm wrong, is that the countries that now Jordan seems to have stepped up, but Saudi Arabia, the Emirates and so on would do more, David, if the U.S. did more. And we just have about a minute left here.
I think one of the problems is that our short and long-term ambitions are not aligned with our own allies. And I think one of the things that makes President Obama and his advisors very cautious is that they worry that some of those Gulf monarchies, for example, have totally different ambitions in the long term in Syria, in the region, that there are people who would like to see a kind of gigantic sectarian sort of conflict between Sunnis and Shias, and that America has no business being dragged into that. So you're right that there is any amount of frustration from Gulf Arab allies about how much America is doing. They would like to see America do more. But this administration will also tell you in private, we're not about to become, you know, the air force for the Gulf monarchies
mm-hmm.
Because we don't want to get dragged into the sectarian conflict that we fear they have in
mm-hmm.
mind.
Well, we're going to see a Republican presidential race starting very soon. Actually, I'll be surprised if the Republican presidential candidates are saying we should do a great deal more. But we'll find out soon as that presidential race is picked up very, very early. In any case, that's all the time we have. Joining us today were David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist, and for the first time on our program, Gopal Rotman, Senior Staff Writer at Foreign Policy Magazine. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Fred Barnes of The Weekly Standard. Thank you for listening.
From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Issues in the News. You can email your questions or comments to our panelists. Send them to voanews@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune in the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us next week at this time for Issues in the News.